Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome back Tim Robbins. Well, how does it feel for you watching it today? You know, as somebody who's been attacked so recently for speaking their mind, what feelings come up when you're sitting there watching this film?
I was thinking, you know, it's always, you know, you always see somebody, you say, oh, I could have, you know, done that, and I could have done that. But no, it was great because I haven't seen it with an audience since it came out. So that was cool.
And just to jump back, because I, you know, when I watch this film, I keep thinking how fresh it is and how, you know, up to date it is. But just to jump back to the time it was made, this was made. I mean, the first appearance of Bob Roberts was on a Saturday Night Live short film. Is that right?
I did a short film. Back then, he was just a businessman. And as I kept writing it, his ambitions grew, and he became a politician.
Okay.
But it was originally written. I came back actually to do a movie called Five Corners here in New York, and I hadn't been back home. I grew up here in Greenwich Village, and hadn't been back for about 6 or 7 years. And I had noticed such a gentrification had happened in my old neighborhood, you know, and a lot of where there were old first generation immigrants with stores, now there were David's Cookies. And so I kind of was revolted by that, and so I started writing this character of a yuppie folk singer.
Judging from the credits where there are so many Robbins members, yeah. I guess, of the Robbins family, you seem to have a musical background. You
know, yeah, my dad was a folk singer, actually. Yeah, yeah. He was in a group called the Highwaymen. And I saw a lot of those old folk concerts, so that stuff is really in our blood, and me and my brother wrote the song. Paying homage to his past, he's the preacher in the church. My dad, my sister Gabrielle is the one that sings outside the hospital, "Prevailing Tides," and yeah.
And what was it like making the film at this time? I mean, you had major studio, you had Miramax, but Paramount involved, so it's a major studio film. The culture wars are going on. I mean,
It wasn't
at the time that you made it.
Well, when I made it, it was Working Title. It was actually an English company that gave me the money to do it. No American company.
Okay, you went out and made it.
Yeah, and
okay.
So the reason why Miramax and Paramount became involved is because we got it into Directors Fortnight at Cannes and showed it there, and it became such a big hit there. Mm. And so people were interested bidding on it in Cannes, and that's how it got sold to Miramax and Paramount.
Okay. And was that during, I mean, if it was released in 92, I guess, was it, it was sort of in the midst of the election.
It was, yeah, it was before the election.
Yeah.
So it came out in September, and the election that Clinton won was in November that year.
Yeah.
So it became a part of the political landscape at the time.
Yeah. And what was the climate? I mean, it's just you know, amazing the sort of cultural situation today when you really, you know, if you speak out in opposition to what the president is doing, it's seen as unpatriotic by a lot of people.
Well,
what kind of response? I mean,
I was happy to hear that line in there. Yeah. I had forgotten about that line in the television interview that Lynn Thigpen is doing early on in the film, where she says, "Well, you're saying to criticize the president is unpatriotic," which is so. I guess that's been around for a long time.
Now, you did feel. I mean, we were talking before the screening about this, but you did feel like this film might have an impact in. You know, in the election, for example. I mean, you know, it's a comedy, but there was a real intention to be doing something politically with it.
Well, I thought it was necessary to bring up Iran-Contra, which somehow just got swept under the rug, and I guess you could kind of substitute Enron right now for that. seems we never really.
In case anybody remembers that.
Yeah, I mean no one went to jail for that.
Yeah, and just talk about sort of, I guess, writing this and creating the characters, particularly the. the sort of liberal characters of Gore Vidal's Brickley Paste and then Giancarlo Esposito's characters, who are saying things that we presume you agree with. You know, in some ways you make Brickley Paste, you know, the kind of liberal that gets attacked so easily as being old-fashioned liberal.
Yeah, and Bugs is kind of extremist. So, yeah, I think you have to be accurate in the way you portray those people as well. And, you know, I didn't want to have a knight in shining armor on a horse. I just didn't think it would work because there really are no people like that. But Gore brought a lot of that to the movie. And there's one, that scene where he's got his tie off was an unscheduled scene. We shot it one day when we were on a location, and we just basically took 2 hours out of the schedule, and I asked if I could interview him after he was defeated by Bob Robertson. So a lot of that is just Gore, just, you know, bringing his knowledge and his perspective of the political scene.
And in terms of what films you had in mind, I mean, some, you know, Robert Altman did a sort of fake documentary, Tanner 88, which had a mix of documentary and fiction techniques, and The Player was made around this time. Was Robert Altman particularly an influence in what you...
Oh, well, he's always been an influence. I mean, one of the films that kind of changed the way I look at films was Nashville. I love the multi-layered storytelling in that. I guess the biggest influence on this film was Pennebaker's Don't Look Back, which is, I ripped off a couple of scenes from...
Free Will and Bob Roberts, yeah.
Yeah. The video of the Wall Street Rap is from that, and the scene where he's in the back of the bus and he's typing, and his Clarissa is playing the guitar. It's a scene in Pennebaker's film where Joan Baez is playing the guitar and he's typing. Dylan is typing. So that was a major influence on this film.
Well, a question about working with actors, and this is your first feature film as a director, so just if you could talk about, and an amazing cast. I mean, it's just amazing the people who pop up in this film.
Having been an actor myself, I love actors. I just love them. I respect everything they do, and so that when I get a chance to work with them and draw things out of them, I don't know specifically what it is, but it's I have a deep love for them. So when the sets are usually very protected and very welcoming for actors, I don't like directors that play trips, you know, to try to get performances out of you and manipulate you and, you know, do emotional stuff. I learned a great deal from working with the Actors Gang in Los Angeles and writing and directing for them. And one of the things that we started working on about 3 years after we started was a workshop process that has no negativity in it. So when it revolves around being coming on stage in an emotion, and that's all it takes, as long as you're in an emotion. And what it eliminates is that thing where you do scene study and everyone criticizes it at the end. There's no criticism allowed. Actors know if it works or if it doesn't work. You don't have to sit around and have a post-mortem where everyone, you know, talks about what didn't work. You know what I mean? That's ultimately destructive. So we try to create an environment when we're working together as in the Actors Gang that's purely positive and purely supportive.
And of course you're interested in the idea of politics as performance. I mean, the idea that politicians are acting all the time too.
Yeah, some of them are pretty good too.
Was this a hard film to get financed?
Oh yeah, it was. It took about 5 years to get the money for it. Yeah. First of all, I hadn't directed before, but it was actually Mark Johnson and Barry Levinson kind of provided the final push for it to happen, and their endorsement of it, involvement in it, really helped it happen. It's really hard, you know, when you're trying to convince someone to give you, you know, a couple million dollars to do something that's in your head, you know. And I put it on in the script as much as I could, but, you know, this kind of film, a lot develops on the set, so they had to trust. And I think it was helpful that I had the player coming out, and so, you know.
Okay, well, is there improvisation? I mean, this is in the documentary style.
Sometimes I just had like a framework, and then I can't remember because it's all was a lot of it was written at the last minute kind of things. You know, we'd talk about it, and then I'd script something the night before. I probably wouldn't be able to work with a major studio film because of that process. You know, I really love rewriting at the last minute, and that makes them really nervous. But it really helps because you're in the moment, in the creative moment on a film, and you know what's working, and you get in. So I oftentimes at the end of the day after dailies, I'll go home and rewrite this scene for the next day, which the actors kind of hate, actually, because there's no coverage. You know, usually you do a master and then you move in for a two shot and then get the close-ups, but because of because it's a documentary, it can only be one shot. So what we would do is we would oftentimes just rehearse the scene and where the camera is, and there's a lot of shots that are done in one. And so it was more the theatrical training of the actors was really came in handy because they could hit marks, but also developed a performance as the rehearsal went, and then it would be there for the film.
You're obviously satirizing some of the characters, but they're sort of playing them straight in a way. So is there anything about working, like getting
There's an expression, play the lie, which is for actors, which is a real important thing, you know, that you're never lying. You're always telling the truth. So play the lie. The lie is the truth.
I should mention that he's going to Cannes in 2 days for the premiere of Mystic River with Clint Eastwood's film.
Yeah, it's a good one, yeah. Clint Eastwood is the best.
As a director.
Well, as a person, too. He's really, really decent human being. And he's, you know, it's such a great lesson because, you know, I have a picture of Jimmy Stewart in my office, mainly there because he's one of my favorite actors of all time, but also mainly because he was a Republican. And I want him there to remind me that that kind of stuff doesn't matter. When you're talking about this kind of thing with creative process, I think people too often make judgments about all Republicans in a way that's really not going to get us anywhere. You know, there's an awful lot of Republicans that contacted me after the Baseball Hall of Fame controversy in support, basically saying, you know, I don't agree with your politics, but you have a right to express them. And we have to remember that when we're trying to, you know, create unity, it's really important not to make judgments on people simply because they're Republicans or Libertarians or Green Party or Democrats. You know, this just as for me, it's really more about how you treat people and what kind of person you are.
How much shooting did you do? I mean, what was the shooting ratio like? Did you shoot a lot more than you used?
Not much. No, yeah. We didn't have much money. We didn't have much stock, so we had to make it work. And so we would do about, you know, some of the one-shots we'd do more takes with because it was all we had. But never over 4 or 5 takes, which is more than I did with Clint Eastwood, who only does 2 takes. And it really, you get in this really incredible mode of discipline and focus when you're working with him.
Okay, just if you could say anything about working on Shawshank Redemption, which was a very influential film.
At the time, we didn't have any idea it would become what it's become culturally and emotionally and spiritually for people. It was done in Ohio, in Mansfield, Ohio. And it was a great script, one of the best I've ever read. And we shot it in the summer in a working prison, and it was a great experience. You know, Morgan has become a really good friend, and I'm really moved by the fact that so many people view that film as important, and it makes me feel great to have been part of that.
How much rehearsal did you do?
This film we would do, depend on the scene, but like for that scene that goes all the way down the hall at the beauty pageant and around, we had to do about, you know, 6 rehearsals without him holding the camera because that was so difficult. It was a heavy camera, too. It wasn't one of those lightweight things, so we had to save that for the actual shooting, and then I think shot it maybe 4 times.
How much of your experience on tape heads came through when you were directing?
Oh, not much. It's hard for me to remember that film because I was really groggy when I was doing it, and then the last week of shooting, I went to see a doctor, and it turns out I had mononucleosis while I was shooting that film. I couldn't understand why my attitude was so bad and I had no energy, you know? I was like...
There's so many people just say Hollywood actors should not be political. You mentioned Michael Moore. He got a lot of criticism. I mean, tons of criticism for making a political statement.
I wonder what people would think if they said that doctors shouldn't be political or bakers shouldn't be political or auto mechanics shouldn't be political. I mean, it's ridiculous. We're all citizens. We all have a right. I think what upsets them is that we might have some access to the media, and that when we do, that oftentimes they are uncomfortable with that, and I can understand why, but that doesn't mean we don't have the right to it.
Is it difficult to maintain creative control today as a director?
I've been really lucky because I've had this other career, so I've been able to say no, but it is difficult for some. I learned a really important lesson early on about a director I worked with. We were at Dailies, and it was this third day of shooting, and we were at Dailies, and I heard this commotion behind me, and I look over, and I see the director has taken the producer up and lifted him up and has got him pressed against the wall, and he says, "You ever talk to any of my actors again, I'll fucking kill you," in front of everybody. And I realized this is his first movie, and from that point on, he was left alone. Now, he was taking a chance there. I mean, he could have been fired, but he what he did was he set the limit, and he said, "I'm going to make my movie, or you can fire me. Either one is good." And I think that that's a really good mindset to have, to be able to believe in what you're doing and have confidence in what you're doing, and then to be able to fight like a junkyard dog to get it.
Do you give actors a lot of leeway, or do you have strong control on the set?
I think that what you're looking for is someone that will bring ideas in, and I don't think strict control on a set is a good idea, because it keeps creativity from happening if they think that they have to fulfill your vision of what it is. You're there to guide and to catch people if they fall, or to try to guide people towards a more, to refine a performance, but not to create it. You can't create it. They have to bring it. And you want people that are confident and believe in what they're doing and can bring you stuff that challenges you. And if they're not comfortable saying a line, I have no problem rewriting it.
Okay, Cradle Will Rock, which is about the whole WPA theater. What was the inspiration for you to make that film?
Inspiration was hearing the story about what happened that night when they defied the ban against them and performed this play. It was just such an amazing story about creative freedom and expression, and people risking their jobs, but and their livelihood, and perhaps their lives, because I think 2 weeks before that incident of Cradle of Rock happened, there was some riots, labor riots in Chicago, where the cops killed like 16 people. So there were cops in the theater, and they were armed. And so I think it was a really amazing kind of testament to the individual. That one woman that stood up and started the ball rolling, that for me was really what freedom is all about. And so when I heard that story, I started doing research about the time, and then all those other stories started finding their way into the script.
Just talk a little bit about your screenwriting, because you've written all the films you directed. I mean, just tell it, like, what is that process like for you, this writing process?
That's the lonely part, you know, and then when you're finished with the script, you don't want anyone, you know, I usually show it to my wife, and I don't want her to say anything negative, you know. All I want to hear is it's brilliant.
And what do you hear?
Well, you know, first, you know, she says it's brilliant, but... But that one, Cradle, happened over a long period of time because I kept researching. But Dead Man Walking came really fast. The adaptation was a lot easier to do than the invention of the whole thing.
Okay, well, Dead Man Walking, which showed both sides of the story and was so even-handed but so personal at the same time, I think you said. Was that in the, you know, was that what the book was like, or was that what you brought to it?
Well, the book... because the book has this revelation that Helen has when she realizes that she was not thinking about the parents, And that for me was the key in the book, was the her stumbling, her good intentions, but her total lack of knowledge of the overall picture and how that developed with her experience. And for me, that's when I was reading the book, that's when that was the movie, you know, because it was about her fallibility in this horrendous situation. And so it was really essential to give dignity to the people that had lost their loved ones.
As you saw Sister Helen Prejean recently speak and say that this film was right on the mark. She was shocked that you called her when you read her book.
Well, actually, Susan found the book and forced me to read it. And I'm glad she did. She's told me that, she goes all around the country and talks, and she shows the film first. And then she says that the film is really a gift because it kind of it tills the soil, as she puts it, for her to begin a discussion with people about it. And she says she has sensed a sea change in America about it. And and poll numbers have gone from when it came out about 85% for to about 60 now. So something's going on. People are thinking a little bit more about it, maybe.
Okay, so a question about advice for screenwriters, and is screenwriting as hard for you as it is for Nicolas Cage in adaptation?
Yes, it's like a nightmare. I love that film because I've been through the process, and you go, oh my God, this is so bad, and then you know. But the great thing is, since computers, because I started writing scripts, plays, and stuff on typewriters, and you'd have to retype the whole damn thing, and now you could just move scenes around. It really was, what a revelation that was, to just be able to delete it and then insert it somewhere else. I think the key is to get it done, you know, just to go get the story out there, get the whole thing done, knowing that you're going to rewrite it. No one can write a script from beginning to end and it's all there. And I've rewritten my thing so many times. Cradle of Rock, I must have rewritten 15 times, 15 different drafts. It's just part of the process. And if you are lucky enough at the end, when you have a thing you can read, if you can get five friends and read through it, you'll discover a lot of things about what works and what doesn't, and you'll be able to start adapting what the truth you found into the script. And also, you have to be able to be ruthless with your own stuff and be able to, you know, delete or throw out stuff that you originally thought was great. The great thing also about computers is that you can put that stuff that you delete into a separate file, and you should save it, because sometimes later, after you finish that third draft, you go into that little file and you'll find something, a real gem that you thought sucked but now would really work well. So we used to cut and paste when we were working on plays, because we didn't have time to rewrite the whole thing. You know, the subconscious will come up with things that makes no sense and that sometimes don't work, but there's a reason it came. So it's good sometimes just to store that stuff away, and also, when you finish your draft, leave it alone for a couple months. Just let it lay. Don't think it's going to do anything right away, and then all that stuff that's in there will be gestating in you as well. So
thank you, and good luck with Mystic River and Can.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.